Good morning, everyone. I'm calling the Senate Committee on Judiciary to order. Thank you for being here. We're pretty much going to go through the order of the bills as they are listed. I will give you a heads up that the second and third bill, Senate Bill 543 and 531, we will be taking testimony today, but we will not be able to move those bills forward because we don't have all the paperwork. Even if we're ready to go on the policy, we need to have the paperwork in place. With that, we'll start with our first public hearing. I'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 558. Counsel?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 558 will revise Oregon's version of the Uniform Commercial Code, will make substantive revisions to Article 1 and Article 7, and make conforming revisions to the remaining articles. Changes to Article 1 include an expanded definition of good faith, a repeal of the statute of frauds for non-goods personal property valued in excess of $5,000, and the incorporation of course of performance as a contract interpretation tool usable throughout the UCC. Changes to Article 7 will enable the electronic creation and possession of documents of title. There's one amendment before you. There is no revenue impact, and we have a minimal fiscal impact.
All right, thank you. We have two people that are signed up to give testimony. Lane, come on up, and then it's called, is it Beery?
Beer.
And Lane, I'll give you a fair warning. Senator Bonamici warned me that she did not have a chance to read every page of the bill today, and since I always rely on her when it comes to the work that I should have done and I didn't do, you're on.
You can relax, Mr. Chair. I brought a law professor with me.
Oh, excellent.
Mr. Chair,
did we get CLE credit for this?
That's right. There will be a test. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Lane Shetterly. I have had the pleasure to be in front of you in a couple of capacities, and today those capacities are going to merge. I have been in front of you as chair of the Oregon Law Commission and as a commissioner of the from Oregon of the National Conference of Commissioners on Uniform State Laws. One of the charges to the Oregon Law Commission is to deal with Uniform Law Commission bills and tailor them to be ready for adoption in Oregon, and that is what you have today. So this is an amendment to Articles 1 and 7 of the Uniform Commercial Code that was promulgated by the National Conference of Commissioners on Uniform State Laws. We formed a work group here in Oregon to review it and make it ready for adoption to Oregon's Uniform Commercial Code. And so this has been through both the National Uniform Law Commission and also a very representative, hardworking work group of the Oregon Law Commission to bring this before you today. I'm going to turn it over to Professor Carl Beer. Carl was the reporter for the Oregon Law Commission group and is also a commissioner from Oregon to the National Conference. He and I are two of the four commissioners from Oregon to the National Conference, and he teaches in this area, so he knows it very well. The last thing I would say, Mr. Chair, for the record, you have before you, of course, the bill and the amendment, which is a conflict amendment that comes with the endorsement of the Oregon Law Commission, but also you have the report of the Oregon Law Commission work group on this, and we have attached to that copies of the full Uniform Act, including the Uniform Commentary. So the legislative record on this will include both the Oregon Law Commission work group report as well as the commentary from the Uniform Law Commission. So you have an extensive legislative record on this that will assist lawyers and judges to the extent they need to research interpretation and meaning and application in the future. We don't plan to go through all of the reports this morning. I'll ask Carl to give you the overview.
Professor Beer's testimony, I'll just put you on notice that you may want to stay around for Senate Bill 531.
I heard.
Senator Boquist is might be needing your assistance as to how we do, in fact, expand the legislative history for future reference. Professor.
Thank you, Chairman Prozanski, members of the committee. I appreciate the opportunity to address you this morning on Senate Bill 558. I'll keep my remarks brief because I know you have a full schedule, but of course I'd be happy to take any questions you might have.
The bill
as has been mentioned, is a proposed set of amendments to two articles of the Uniform Commercial Code, Articles 1 and 7. The Uniform Commercial Code as a whole is a very large and important statutory corpus that governs commercial transactions, voluntary business transactions among consenting parties. Different articles of the code address different substantive areas, and we'll mention just a couple of those. Article 1, though, is what I would call an umbrella provision. That is to say, coming at the beginning of the code, it's a set of definitions, like would appear in any statute, that apply throughout the substantive body of the code. It also provides general principles and rules of interpretation that also filter through in sort of an umbrella way throughout the substantive areas of the code. Three of the areas that I'd like to briefly highlight today in the bill are amendments to the Article 1 provisions. The fourth of the substantive areas is for Article 7 of the code, which governs documents of title. Briefly, documents of title are trying to keep things brief. They are issued by warehouses or transportation facilities who, in the ordinary course of their business, they accept goods that belong to others for transport or for storage. Paradigm would be farm crops that are stored in a silo, and the silo issues what we call a warehouse receipt to the owner that evidences that owner's right to get the goods back. Similarly, bills of lading issued by a railroad or by a moving company, things like that, some of us have received those in our own lives when we've used professional moving companies, evidences our rights to get the goods back after transport. And these are important to certain kinds of commercial transactions. The documents themselves can be bought and sold and used as evidence of people's rights, not only the owner or a new owner in the case of a transfer, but for example, in a secured lending situation where a bank acquires rights to the goods that are being stored or transported as collateral, and the document of title is an important backstop to the rights of that secured lender. So those are the substantive areas that we're talking about. I'd like to just briefly mention the four issues that are highlighted in the Oregon Law Commission report that you have, going in order that they appear in the report. The first area is course of performance. This is an Article 1 provision because it would apply to all of the substantive areas of the Uniform Commercial Code. Course of performance is basically a tool for contract interpretation. In general, contracts consist not only of the words that parties have actually set down to paper, but also other interpretive tools that help give meaning and context to those words. Course of performance is one of those important tools. It refers to the situation where the performance of a contract consists of repeated occasions for action by one side or the other, payment after payment, delivery after delivery, provision of collateral after provision of collateral, et cetera, et cetera. And the idea behind course of performance is that where the words of the contract that are on the page are not explicit enough, the prior occasions that the parties have accepted performance from each other are important evidence of what the contract actually means. In other words, we don't just look at the words to judge the actions of the parties, but in one of these long-term contracts, the actions of the parties sort of conversely contribute meaning to the words. Right? If there's acceptance of each other's actions over a course of time, we can at least have a good basis for believing that that's what the contract means. We already have in the Oregon Revised Statute and nationwide course of performance in Article 2 of the Uniform Commercial Code. That's governing sales of goods. But, of course, that's just one of the substantive areas of the code. And what the bill would do is take this contract interpretation tool, move it to Article 1, where it would thereby become applicable throughout the substantive areas. The second issue I'd like to touch on is the definition of good faith. good faith is also a contract interpretation tool. Slightly more complicated, I suppose, but it's the same general idea. The words on the page do not always fully spell out what the parties expect from each other in a consensual transaction, and good faith helps to flesh out the meaning of those words. Article 1 here in Oregon and also nationwide already provides, in very general terms, that every contract carries with it an implied obligation of good faith. That is, it's generally understood as meaning that the parties will cooperate with respect to the goals of the transaction. It's a very general idea. Where the issue has been and what the bill would address is not this general obligation of good faith, but the definition of good faith for that general obligation. Currently, Article 1 defines good faith, and so this general duty that's imposed is expressed just in terms of honesty and fact. What the bill would do is flesh out that definition so that it includes both honesty and fact and the observance of reasonable commercial standards of fair dealing. Basically, subjective honesty today enhanced by objective reasonableness of conduct in the bill. And this is designed to, in keeping with the overall idea of good faith as a contract interpretation tool, it enhances the certainty that parties have when they first enter into transactions about what they can expect from their counterparts. It's impossible to foresee every eventuality that might arise in the course of a transaction, and so it's impossible to explicitly draft language that takes care of all those eventualities. But the general expectation of parties is that they can expect a certain degree of faithfulness to the purpose of the transaction, and this idea of adding reasonableness to the definition of good faith furthers that goal. Now, standing by itself, this amendment to the definition of good faith in Article 1 would be a medium-sized step in law reform, very much in keeping with actions across the country and evolving ideas, but against the background of other actions that we've already taken in Oregon, numerous previous amendments to the Uniform Commercial Code, this Article 1 amendment really should be seen more as a cleaning up of leftover issues. Just briefly to explain that idea, just about each of the substantive areas of the Uniform Commercial Code has its own definition of good faith that applies in certain contexts, not for purposes of the general Article 1 duty, but for purposes of whatever the particular substantive rule is in Article 2 or 3 or 8 or 9 or whatever it might be. And each of those definitions, with just one exception, specialized exception that I've mentioned in footnote 7 of the report, has already been amended in Oregon and nationwide to provide this dual standard of not only honesty but also objective reasonableness. So what we're doing is cleaning up the Article 1 general rule so that it's in harmony with the substantive rules that we already have. The last Article 1 provision is repeal of a little-known statute of frauds governing sales of personal property in amounts beyond $5,000. This is not to be confused with what's probably more familiar statute of frauds in Article 2 regarding sales of good for more than $500. This is for sales of other personal property, and by its nature it's sort of unusual personal property. If I sell a half interest in my securities account, if I sell half of the rights to the grain that I've stored in a silo, things like that. Currently, Article 1 provides that contracts for the sale of that kind of personal property is not enforceable unless in writing and signed by the person against whom this enforcement is sought. And this is a problematic provision. Statutes of frauds in general sort of proceed on the assumption that there's only one reliable way to prove the authenticity of a transaction. They're designed to protect people against false allegations of transactions, therefore they prohibit enforcement unless the person, the defendant, in essence, has signed evidence of the transaction. The problem is that there are at least as many legitimate transactions that have truly been entered into, but that aren't documented by signed writing, as there are false allegations of transactions that haven't been entered into and that would be squelched by the statute of frauds. So provisions like this are at best ambiguous. They thwart legitimate transactions at least as much as they protect against illegitimate transactions. And in particular, this Article 1 statute of frauds that the bill would repeal is poorly crafted. It's a blanket prohibition on enforcement. It's without some of the nuanced exceptions that we have in other statutes of frauds that are throughout the code and elsewhere in the Oregon statutes. The thought here is that if the state wished to retain the statute of frauds along these lines, the Uniform Commercial Code is not the place to do it, and generally we feel that in keeping with sort of a retreat from this kind of formality that the law has been following for quite some time, that this particular provision ought to be repealed. The last of the four provisions is the Article 7 provision. I mentioned the nature of electronic documents of title. What the thrust of the bill's amendments to Article 7 would do is to recognize electronic documents of title and enable transactions to take place in electronic form, to enable the documents of title to be transferred from person to person by electronic means. The idea is to get away from a purely paper-based system. By doing that, we enable transactions to happen quickly, which in a global economy is important. We enable them to happen at long distance, which enables counterparties to deal across borders or across international borders without waiting for pieces of paper to travel. And there are a number of provisions in the bill, I won't belabor them, that A, recognize the validity of these electronic documents of title, and B, provide for a reliable means of transfer of them. So that's my brief substantive summary of the bill. I'll just mention that the uniform versions of the bill, which as Lane mentioned, are products of the uniform laws process, have been enacted in 35 states in the case of Article 1, 31 states, I believe, in the case of Article 7. Several of our neighboring states have already enacted them, and a similar bill is pending in Washington State during this legislative session.
Last thing I'd like to mention is
the official commentary to the statute. The statute itself is carefully drafted, but as a part of that uniform laws process, there is extensive commentary drafted by people that devote their lives to these things. No accounting for taste, I suppose. It is very helpful guidance to the intent behind some of the statutes. I think it deserves careful consideration by yourselves and by the rest of the legislature in considering the bill. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Questions, comments?
Quick question.
Senator Boquist.
Lane, I mean, 31 to 35 adopt and so on and so forth. Could you just briefly overview 35 rejected whatever liberalized provisions are? I'm not clear what those are, but why did they reject those? And then I'm assuming you can give just a brief comment. I mean, obviously this is good for business and the business community supports this.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, the history of the Uniform Commercial Code has been is really one of the great success stories of the uniform laws process. And in fact, it's one of those key laws that benefit business and particularly interstate commerce by providing a common system of laws from state to state, so that if you are a seller selling goods into from Oregon selling goods into Oklahoma, you have comfort in terms of what the laws are. It creates expectations that can be fulfilled. So in terms of the Uniform Commercial Code itself and keeping the Uniform Commercial Code current, it's all very good for just in abstract law improvement, but also in particular for business. The provisions that have not been enacted, actually I'll turn that over to Professor Bierre. There was, out of the gate, I think, an element of controversy to these amendments that's been abated. By the way, states have dealt with it, and the Uniform Commission has acknowledged that as well.
Just for clarification, Senator Boquist, does your question relate to the
I'll just 35 said states said no, we're not going to do the liberalized provision. Just very quick overview of what we said no to.
Oh, conflict of laws,
choice of law provision.
Choice of law, yeah.
Is that what it is?
Yes.
All right. There's been some history to the bill on what we're calling the choice of law provision. There was initially controversy, and that's been settled essentially. The choice of law provision that we currently have in Chapter 71 of the ORS, and that the bill would maintain, provides essentially for parties to a transaction, if you and I are going to sell goods to each other, that we can specify in our contract what law we'd like to be governed by, as long as the law that we choose has a reasonable relationship to our transaction. So if you're located in Oregon and I'm located in Washington, we could specify either Oregon or Washington. If we're selling goods to each other that are located in Texas, Texas would also have a reasonable relationship. And we could choose that. At one point, the national bill would have liberalized the choice of law provisions so that any jurisdiction could have been chosen, even one having nothing to do with the transaction. And as you could imagine, this was controversial because it opens the possibility for sort of strategic abuses. It's been rejected. It's not in our bill. It hasn't been adopted anywhere because people have decided they'd rather keep the current regime.
Thank you. Any other questions or comments?
Mr. Chair, I have applied for a half hour of CLE credit for this. But,
I do
have to share
that
as well.
You know, this reminds me back in my law school days why I relied so heavily on Gilbert's and my study partner, just because UCC was not one of my, you know, say, favorite areas, as it is for, I know, for many others.
Mr. Chair, if I may add to that, I didn't have Professor Bierre. I had Professor Mooney, and the general understanding about UCC was that was what happened when you got your grade.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you, Professor. Thank you very, very much for being here and giving us your knowledge. Any other questions or comments? I'm going to go ahead and. Is there anyone else who wanted to come forward and give us testimony today on Senate Bill 558? I guess not. Everyone that's, let's say, been through those courses. Flashback, and I saw David Niebel that you got your copy, so I think you can apply for 30 minutes, and Wendy can help you with the forms. With that, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 558, and I'm going to go ahead and open up a work session on Senate Bill 558. And Council, I understand we need to pick the dash ones and adopt them.
That's correct, Senator.
Chair, move the dash ones into Senate Bill 558.
Senator Boquist moves the dash ones in Senate Bill 558. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill SB 558 as adopted with the dash ones to the floor with the due class. And Mr. Chair, I don't want to carry it.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I will only vote for it if I don't have to carry it.
Senator Boquist moves Senate Bill 558 as amended by the dash ones to the floor with a due pass recommendation with the caveat. With those, any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. And Senator Dingfelder, I am going to ask you to carry this. We'll have, as a second, if necessary, Senator Bonamici and I discussed this, and she said that she will pinch hit if you need any assistance.
Do I get an honorary law degree for carrying this?
By the time you get out of this session, you may have one. With that, we'll close the work session. Thank you all very, very much. All right, we're going to change counsel, and as we're changing counsel, and Stephen, thank you very much for coming up and being part of the process today. We're going to go ahead and go to our next public hearing. This will be for Senate Bill 543. And, counsel, if you can give us a brief overview.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 543 requires a court to enter a limited judgment if it denies a special motion to strike. This is an anti-slap suit provision. It's from the American Civil Liberties Union. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. And we have two individuals that are here to give testimony, or it looks like maybe three. So I'm going to call Charles Hinkle, Maria DiMichele, and Andrea Meyer. All right. And Charlie, were you going to start off, or how are we going to do this?
I think Charlie's.
Okay.
I'm happy to just start off briefly and say, Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee, Andrea Meyer, Legislative Director for the ACLU of Oregon, pleased today to bring forward to you Senate Bill 543 at the behest of Charlie Hinkle, a longtime cooperating attorney for the ACLU. Charlie will walk you through the bill, and then my legal intern from University of Oregon, Maria DiMichele, will speak briefly on behalf of the ACLU on this proposal. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. My name is Charles Hinkle. I've been practicing law in Portland for 37 years, and a large part of it has been in free speech areas, which this bill addresses. This bill is a lot shorter than the one you just considered, and it's working well. The legislature passed the SLAPP statute in 2001. It was largely promoted by Senator Schrader and Representative Shetterly, whom you just heard from. And its purpose was to deter the filing of lawsuits that impinge on people's free speech rights, and it's had that effect. I think we've seen fewer libel cases and other kinds of tort cases brought against people who testify in public hearings or who write letters to the editor or who participate in talk shows or whatever, any kind of exercise of free speech on an issue of public importance. So it has that purpose of deterring the filing of these lawsuits. And secondly, once one of these lawsuits is filed, it's had the very good effect of getting them resolved quickly and expeditiously. And if the trial court determines that they should not have been brought in the first place because these are an impingement on free speech rights, then the defendant wins his or her attorney's fees. So it's been, and as I say, it's working well. I don't know the overall number of cases that have been brought, but it's in the last 7 years, it's probably, you know, in the order of 20, I would guess, cases in which these motions have been brought. And they've generally been granted. And I think we're going to see a diminishment of that because as the bar and the public in general get acquainted with the SLAPP statute, they realize they better think twice about bringing one of these lawsuits in the first place, which was the whole point of the lawsuit, of the original bill back in 01. So it's working well, and the Court of Appeals has issued a good opinion that I've cited there in paragraph 3, giving it some construction in paragraph 4. That Court of Appeals interpretation that I've set out there, I think, is the correct one, and I just set it out there for your kind of your background information. So that brings me to why we're here this morning. If on page 2 of my written submission to you at the top there, I told you that the Oregon statute was modeled after the California statute. The California statute originally did not have a provision allowing for an immediate appeal if your motion was denied. Somebody files a lawsuit against you for libel or invasion of privacy or any other kind of tort based on your free speech rights, then you file the anti-slap motion. But if the trial court grants the motion, fine, the case is over, you get your attorney's fees and free speech rights have been vindicated. But if the trial court denies your motion, then you have to go through the expense of discovery, depositions, the expense of trial, and all that. And then if you win at the end of it, that shows that your anti-slap motion should have been granted in the first place, and you've had to incur all those expenses, which was the very thing that the statute, the anti-SLAPP statute was intended to avoid. So the California legislature, in the indented quotation there on page 2, recognized that problem. The legislature concluded it was necessary to authorize an immediate appeal because without this ability, a defendant will have to incur the cost of the lawsuit before having his or her free speech rights vindicated. When a meritorious anti-SLAPP motion is denied, the defendant under current law has only two options. The first is to file a writ, and in Oregon that would be a writ of mandamus with the Oregon Supreme Court, which is discretionary and rarely granted. That's true in Oregon as well. The second option is to go ahead and defend the whole lawsuit, not just the trial, but the expense of all the discovery. And then if the defendant wins after trial, the SLAPP law is useless. It's failed to accomplish its purpose because the defendant has had to go through all that expense. So the California legislature then added a provision to its statute saying if your motion to is denied, you can take an immediate appeal. And that's what I'm asking you to do as well. And the mechanism for doing it in the Oregon, under Oregon law, is simply to add a provision, as you'll see in the bill itself, line 10 on page 1, just saying if a court denies the motion, the court shall enter a limited judgment. That accomplishes the goal of allowing an immediate appeal because under the judgment statute in Chapter 18 of ORS, a limited judgment is immediately appealable. So this, the wording in other states is different, but this is appropriate wording for Oregon because a limited judgment has now has appeared in several of our statutes, and when that happens, when that is done, when that's filed, you can take an immediate appeal from it. As it stands right now, there's no appellate review of a SLAPP motion at all because, if, as I say, if it's been denied and then you go through trial and you take and you, well, you win or lose, either party then takes the appeal, the Oregon Court of Appeals has said, well, you can't then examine whether the anti-SLAPP motion should have been granted because after a trial, the only thing we're going to look at as an appellate court is what happened at the trial and the ultimate judgment. We're not going to look at all these preliminary matters. So as it stands right now, there, the denial of an anti-SLAPP motion is subject to no appellate review whatever in Oregon. So we think, I think, it ought to be done at that initial stage. The whole purpose of this statute, this SLAPP statute, is to nip these kinds of lawsuits in the bud, and this provision would do that. So paragraph 9 on page 3 of my testimony, by authorizing an immediate appeal, this bill, 543, makes it clear that the statute, the Oregon statute, is intended to provide a substantive immunity from trial. It's not just a matter of the trial court making an early assessment of the evidence.
That doesn't accomplish much.
The whole point is to provide an immunity from having to go through the expense of trial altogether. The experience in other states, paragraph 10, similar kind of statements there from Massachusetts and Minnesota. The whole point of the anti-SLAPP statute is lost. All of its benefits are lost if you don't allow an immediate appeal. Paragraph 12, citing statutes from 5 other states in which they have, using various languages, a language in their statutes, allowed for an immediate appeal. As I say, we do it slightly differently because of our limited judgment provision. So that's really all I have to say about the appeal provision, Mr. Chair. I think it is a modest amendment. One question you might have is how many appeals would this bring about? And I suspect it would be maybe one a year, if that. And it really wouldn't add any burden to the appellate courts because right now, if your anti-SLAPP motion is denied and you really feel strongly about it, you're going to file a writ of mandamus with the Oregon Supreme Court anyway. So an appellate court is already involved. I think it's just cleaner and neater under normal appellate practice to go to the Court of Appeals and let that court decide the issue. At the end of my testimony under paragraph F, paragraphs 13, 14, and 15, I do suggest that the committee consider adding one other provision to the bill, and it's the language that I have at the very end. Paragraph 15, the statute shall be liberally construed in favor of the exercise of the right of expression described in the statute. And I propose that because California found after some years of litigation that was a good thing too, just to kind of nudge the courts to say that we really mean this. The statute is here to protect free expression. And some people say, well, you shouldn't tell the courts to liberally construe or narrowly construe or any other kind of construe. Just let the courts construe the language. But in paragraph 14, I've cited there 49 statutes in which you've already told the courts to liberally construe something, from the UCC, which you've just heard about, or the convention facilities, family planning, polygraph examiners. I mean, if anything should be liberally construed in Oregon, it's the right of free expression. So I think I would urge you to consider adding that clause that I have there at the very end of my testimony in paragraph 15. That's not in the bill as it is in front of you. The bill, as you have it this morning, addresses only that appeal issue, which I urge you to support, but then also consider the liberal construction issue. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Michi? DiMicelli?
Sorry. DiMicelli. No, it's okay. Marie DiMicelli. I'm a U of O law student and also a legal intern for the ACLU of Oregon. I'm here today to testify in support of SB 543. And actually, this came about because Andrea asked me to do some research on comparing the proposed amendments to statutes already in existence in other states. And like Mr. Hinkle already testified, there are five other states that already allow for a right to appeal. And I actually found 25 anti-SLAPP motion statutes in existence right now. And also that four states contain broadly construed language. And I think the importance of amending, so I would also respectfully ask the committee to support an amendment to allow for the statute to be broadly construed. And as of yet, there has not been a problem with this in Oregon, but there has in California. The first amendment to the California's bill was in 1997, and that was when they had seen a number of cases that were narrowly construed and for only public concern, issues of public concern, and other anti-SLAPP motions were denied. And then also in 1999, that's when California amended theirs to have a right to appeal. So it seems very prudent to do both of those today and just prevent potentially another testimony and whatnot. And I think also in my experience, I've seen that, for example, if Sierra Club brings a lawsuit against a corporation for polluting or something like that, the corporation will turn around and bring libel suits or slander suits against the individuals of Sierra Club and not only the organization. And many of those individuals do not have the funds to properly fund a full anti-SLAPP or fund the full SLAPP motion arena, I'm sorry, SLAPP lawsuit defending their name and their right to free expression. And that's really what's at stake here, is allowing free expression. And that's why the ACLU supports SB 543, and I urge you to please help create important safeguards and protections for free speech, and urge you to pass 543. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. So I'm going to open up for questions, and of course, Charlie, you had to use the L word, and you should have followed Maria's example of the B word, broadly construed, and so liberally construed. All right, so questions, comments?
Have a question.
Well, first we'll go Senator Wissett, then we'll come back this way.
Thank you, Chair Przanski. I just was wondering if this proposal became statute, would it set a precedent for appealing the ruling of judges during trials regarding other subjects? It seems to me that to my knowledge, if a judge rules in the middle of a trial on something, that isn't appealable until
right.
The trial is finished. So this seems to be kind of opening a new venue.
Well, I think that's a good question, Senator. there is no, in Oregon law now, there is no right of interlocutory appeal, as it's called. There's no right to appeal from an evidentiary ruling or any kind of pretrial ruling. Other states, and in the federal system, you can have an interlocutory appeal, for example, an order of preliminary injunction. You in the federal system, you can appeal a preliminary injunction. You can't in Oregon. So Oregon has very narrow rights of appeal, and this would add just a very narrow exception. As I said, since the SLAPP statute was adopted 8 years ago, there probably haven't been more than 20 or 25 cases in which it's been applied. And out of those, I know of only one in which an appeal would have been taken. So you are right. This opens a slight crack in the door that allows this one kind of order to be appealed. But whether that door opens any wider is completely up to this legislature, because this bill itself wouldn't allow any kind of evidentiary ruling at trial or anything else to be appealed. No, it's limited to this denial of a SLAPP motion, and that's one of those once-in-a-blue-moon things.
Senator Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You listed, Charlie, in your testimony in paragraph 14, all the other instances where there's a reference to liberal construction of a statute. Does the absence of that kind of language in a statute mean that because it's not stated that it should be liberally construed, that it should not be liberally construed?
Well, the issue arose in California. Because the California statute, and if you look at Senate Bill 543, the guts of it there, when can you make a special motion to strike on page 1 of it, lines 12 through 22, that is copied verbatim from the California statute. And in California's experience, when their bill was first adopted, some courts were taking a pretty narrow view of what is a statement to a government body, or what is a statement that is made in connection with a public issue or an issue of public interest there on line 22, taking kind of a narrow view of it, a constricted view. And so some anti-SLAPP motions were being denied that should have been granted, the legislature said. Now, I confess, I don't know of many instances in which that's happened yet in Oregon, but I'd rather an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure, and I just, I will tell you this, that the issue has been raised. Some plaintiffs have said, oh, well, you, Mr. or Ms. Defendant, can't file your SLAPP motion against my complaint, because, look, in California, they've got that broadly construed language. Oregon doesn't. Therefore, the Oregon statute provides you, the defendants, less protection than the California statute does, and therefore we're going to read our statute a little more narrowly. Now, that argument hasn't prevailed yet, so far as I know, but I'd prefer that we not give that the opportunity for it to be made. The right of free expression that is guaranteed there, any conduct in furtherance of the exercise of the constitutional right of petition or the constitutional right of free speech in connection with a public issue or an issue of public interest, those are extremely valuable rights that this legislature so determined. 8 years ago, that's the only reason you've passed this statute in the first place. So I think that when a court is asked to determine, well, what is a public issue or what is an issue of public interest, that ought to be broadly construed rather than narrowly. And to go to your point, Mr. Chair, about why I put in liberally construed, you'd have to ask the legislature that. Because the California statutes and every other state does use the word broadly construed, but in 49 instances, for reasons unknown to me, you've used the word liberally construed, and the phrase broadly construed doesn't appear in any Oregon statute. I mean, maybe you ought to just have an amendment saying wherever liberally construed appears, broadly construed shall now be substituted.
Senator Wissett.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Brzezinski. How many times is the word conservatively construed found?
Probably none. The opposite of liberally construed in this context would be narrowly construed, not conservatively construed. So.
And I guess I'll just put on the record that it does seem that our courts have given, when it comes to right of free expression, more of a broadly or liberal interpretation, but I understand that since we actually adopted what was California, that argument could be, and it sounds like it has been made, but just hasn't stuck yet.
It gives somebody something to argue about. Well, why does California say theirs should be broadly construed, and since we copied our statute from California, did the legislature somehow have a different intent here?
Right.
I'd like to eliminate that argument.
Understand. Any other questions or comments? Thank you all very much for coming forward today. Is there anyone else who wants to give testimony today on Senate Bill 543? Not seeing anyone, we'll go ahead and close the public hearing on 543. And we're going to go ahead and open up our next public hearing on Senate Bill 531.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 531 lists legislative history that a court may consider, and this is from Senator Boakes.
Mr. Chair, for the record, this is a direct result of your efforts. You recall on January 15th in the organizational meeting, we asked three judges, one Supreme Court judge and two appeals court judges, to come in and, for a better word, I would say give us new members an education. And what one of those, the two major topics were constitutional law, but the one that we spent the most discussion on was statutory interpretation, and that's the rules the courts follow in what we, the legislature, determined or decided the statute ought to be. And every day that we go by in this building, and probably every day in this committee, all of us say something for the record. So that's in the record of what we want the intent to be or what we really meant. What came out of that educational meeting or informational meeting was the appeals court, when we asked them and said, well, how do you interpret statute? They went to legislative history. Well, what's the legislative history? And then they went on to talk about only the written word counts. And so there was some discussion that time where we said, well, what is legislative history and what do we say as legislators that really count? What is the record we want them to do? And, of course, in doing a little research for that, Mr. Chair, came to the fact that we've never told the judiciary branch what we consider to be important from the legislative branch. And I took a first stab, and Mr. Chair, you and I have talked previously, and it's not a great stab because there's some wide-open freeways here on what came out in the draft. But what my intent was to have a discussion and say, what do we as legislators want to tell the judiciary branch is the most important things that they should consider but not limited to when we pass a bill, whether that be the work session when we have discussion and say this is why we're passing the bill. I know Bill was not happy with the concept of staff measure summaries, but one of the challenges is for us lay people is that we trust the staff measure summary to tell us what this one-inch bill was here that Lane brought up. And so that's the kind of the direction. We've never told in writing the judiciary this is the one or two items, not everything, but the one or two items that we do, so that when we say on the record, what are we telling them? And since they don't like our verbal version, I said, okay, we'll put it in writing. And what I had come up with there, and you can see in the bill, Mr. Chair and colleagues, legislative committee hearings and work session minutes, you know, maybe, as we know, opponents come up and throw all kinds of stuff, and maybe that's not it. Maybe it's work sessions. Likewise, is it what the carrier said on the floor and the intent of the bill? Is it the staff measure summary? And some sort of discussion of what is our one or two items, not to be inclusive, but these are the two or three things that we all say in the 30 members of the Senate and the 60 members of the House. What do we want the judiciary to look at? What's the priority? What has more weight? Was it when Senator Bonamici stood up and opposed the bill? Was it when I stood up and opposed the bill? Was it when the carrier made a presentation? Or was it in work session where we said, this is why we're doing it? Because so many times we say in open hearing, well, for the record, for this, so forth and so forth. And that's what I'm looking for, Mr. Chair, is we have never told them, and I don't think, I would say at least in two sessions, a dozen bills that I've personally been involved with, we've always sent it to an agency, and the agencies, will not say changed it, but haven't exactly interpreted it different. And we're looking, what I was looking for is, I was surprised, especially with all the lawyers like, Representative Shutterly and others before them that were in here, that are great lawyers, that we have never told the judiciary, this is the priority, this is what our written word is right here. Please consider it when you're considering everything else.
All right. Well, thank you for the overview. We do have Gail Myers signed up to give testimony Is there anyone else who wanted to give testimony today on this bill? If so, Sean, come on up. And while you're coming up, I just want to put on the record, since we are making a record here, Senator Boquist, regarding the four items that you have listed on line 14, it says including but not limited to. I'm assuming that A through D are not in any hierarchy or priority. It's just a list of things that should be considered and no super priority.
Mr. Chair, and I'm not wedded to any one of these. I'm just trying to figure out that we all say this every day, but what is it we're really saying? Because if they only take the written word, we should put something in the statute that says, this is what we say the record is.
All right.
Thank you. Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee, Gail Meyer on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. When we saw this bill, I asked several of our appellate practitioners through OPDS and others what they thought of it, and everybody thought it was a good bill. And I would just also remind everyone as we're discussing this that really when the appellate court does look at a statute, it first looks and foremost at the language of the statute. And if they can't glean clear meaning from the language of the statute, then they go behind that for the appellate history. But certainly the practitioners thought that it would be helpful to have a list of things that they were entitled to refer to when on appeal they do argue legislative intent. And so we would indicate our support for the bill. And with the chair's permission, if I might leave at this time, because I had a 9:30 appointment.
That's fine. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thanks. Chair Przanski, members of the committee, for the record, Sean Cleave, Oregon Farm Bureau. I'd like to preface my testimony today with the fact that Oregon Farm Bureau doesn't currently have any policy regarding this issue. We are a policy organization which dictates what we can advocate or not advocate for. So as however, I'd like to put on the record, having sat through many rulemaking processes in agencies and having multiple requests of the judiciary regarding what would be placed on the record or what could be considered part of the record, I can tell you that there is quite a bit of frustration, and if I was a member of the assembly, I would be shocked at times on how little of that record is actually taken into account. In the 90s, and let me also say I'm not an attorney, but I will have our counsel provide you with the case reference and a memo regarding how this particular case law was developed. But in the 90s, I believe it was PGE versus Boley. That case law provided a framework for when legislative language should be referred to in the record. And essentially what it said was, if it's the plain meaning of the language is used in the statute, then there's no reason to look back to the legislative record. So ironically, the plainer you can be, which usually in this building we try to be specific when we're trying to get an intent, but ironically, the plainer you can be, the less likely the legislative record is going to be referred to. And Oregon Farm Bureau has had some problems, specifically in implementation of rules. We have introduced a bill actually this session on the House side to try to clarify what the legislative intent was regarding an estate tax bill that was passed in the 2007 and 2008 special session. So with that, I'll wrap up my testimony, and if you have any questions, I'll do my best to answer.
We're going to ask Lane Shetterly to come up. And the other thing I guess I want to put on the record as well, and Lane, if you'll comment as well on this, is
one of my...
Everything's on the record.
I would like to have his comment. One of my concerns on this is making certain that we don't make the historical legislative record to include the public testimony of witnesses, because we know that in many cases you have people that are extremely energized on whatever side they may be, making statements that may not be fact on whatever side of the issue they may be. And so that's one of the things, again, I will just want to clarify for the record.
And Mr. Chair, I would, because Lane has a breadth of experience with the law commissioner, I'm really looking for input in what maybe should be on the record and what shouldn't be on the record. And
right. Let me tell you what my intent is on this. Is one, we're not moving the bill today, as I said earlier, because we don't have all the stuff we need. And I know Senator Boquist wasn't intending that to occur. And we may have some type of a small work group to see if we can come together. If not, then I'm going to maybe see, maybe even punt to the Law Commission as maybe a project for them to consider. Because this is something that's very significant as to how the courts would, in fact, interpret the work of the legislative branch. Lane.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, again, for the record, Lane Shetterly. Just happy day that I happen to be here for this bill and to hear the anti-SLAPP bill as well. Like, you know, trip down memory lane. This is one that I think would be worth perhaps having council research. My recollection is that former Representative Max Williams did have a bill probably in the 1999-2001 session that addressed PGE versus Boley, and I believe we passed it, but to, I think, limited effect. Courts tend to review statutes the way they want to review statutes. But I'll tell you, if you want history on that, I'm sure it's in the Judiciary Committee records on the House side. I do remember some robust testimony, I think particularly from Supreme Court Judge Mick Gillette, holding forth on how the court reviews statute and what they consider to be legislative history. And just kind of touching on your question, Mr. Chair, I remember very clearly their strong defense of the PGE versus Boley analysis, whereby they determined that the best indicator of legislative intent is what the legislature passes, what it adopts. And their reluctance in the face of an unambiguous statute to go behind that to research intent out of concern that not only witnesses but even legislators may plant things in the record that may be very well at odds with the actual language of the bill, but all of a sudden you get behind it and in the record there is ambiguity, but that ambiguity was never actually voted on. It was never adopted. What was adopted was the bill. The bill speaks for itself if it's unambiguous. That's I can't do it with nearly the vigor that Mick Gillette can do this, but if you want an entertaining hearing, I'd invite him over maybe with Max at the table as well to talk about this, because their positions on this thing are very well rehearsed, and it's an interesting issue with a room full of experts to talk about that. But I do remember very well a series of hearings. Again, it was Representative Williams' bill. I was only the chair of the committee, so I wasn't paying that much attention. But I know Max had a real passion for this, and I'll bet he might be of help to you in ferreting out some of what the distant history of this is in the House side.
Thank you. Senator Boquist.
Elaine, could you expound upon, I mean, in your experience, both in the legislative process and with the Law Commission and others, I mean, what couple of things strike you as being the most important things legislators would say or do for the record?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Boquist, currently, the way it works, if you go to the Oregon Court of Appeals reports or the Oregon Supreme Court reports, you'll see this. First of all, again, in the PGE versus Boley construct, they look at the statute, and if the statute is unambiguous on its face, they don't go into the legislative history. And frankly, as a lawyer, that suits me. If I'm reading a statute, I want to believe what the statute says, and I don't want to have to research every statute, even the ones that appear to be unambiguous and clear, to see if there was some other hidden intent. So that's the way the court approaches it. When the court, though, finds that there is an ambiguity, they do examine the record, the legislative record, and I know in reading cases, it is not uncommon for the court to quote comments by committee members in committee and even testimony of witnesses in the in court opinions as the court is getting into the weeds and interpreting the statutes. When called on, the court will get into hearing, work session, and floor statements as well. So it's all there once the court gets through that first level of the PGE versus Boley analysis. They go to what's relevant, my recollection is from reading that all of those sources have at various times been cited in reported cases as the court has been interpreting what it finds to be an ambiguous statute.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to thank Senator Boquist for bringing this issue forward. And at the risk of being a bit anecdotal, some of you may recall that we passed out of this committee Senate Bill 373, which is a bill that I brought on behalf of a constituent who had the child support issue, where he was paying the child support through a wage withholding order, and the employer was not paying the child support because they had a cash flow problem. And he ended up suing the employer. In that case, a pro tem judge granted him his damages. His credit was damaged. His license had been threatened, even though he was actually paying, but the employer wasn't paying the money. And the pro tem judge issued an order providing for his damages, but the employer appealed to the Court of Appeals. And I didn't review that case in preparation for this hearing today, but I recall that the Court of Appeals, in reversing that trial court judge, did the whole PGE Boley analysis, looked at legislative history, and held that he had no right to recover those damages under the statute. So I have the bill, Senate Bill 373, to correct that. And last weekend I ran into somebody who's now a Multnomah County Circuit Court judge who came up to me at an event and said, I was following that bill that you have. I was part of the group that wrote that statute, and that's not what we meant. The Court of Appeals shouldn't have issued that opinion because that's not what the statute meant. And even though they did that entire PGE Boley analysis in that case. So anything we can do to prevent all of that from happening, because the amount of judicial time and resources that are spent in that, I think, will be a wise investment. So, again, I know there's work to do on this, but thank you for bringing the issue forward.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
One other comment as well, and this follows up on Mr. Cleave's comment, I think also for the executive branch. You know, we pass laws and the executive branch implements them. So I have been in several instances where there's been agency rulemaking where the agency folks have contacted me because there's discussions, debates about what the legislative intent was. And, of course, we're providing sort of more general policy language and the agencies are providing more specific implementation language. So I think your point is well taken that this could also be helpful to agencies when they're interpreting what our intent was when they are actually implementing the programs that we're asking them to do. So I think that I appreciate Senator Boquist bringing this up and look forward to the results.
Yep, great. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you all. I'm going to go ahead and close the hearing on Senate Bill 531 and open our last public hearing on Senate Bill 601.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 601 clarifies the authority of the Board of Maritime Pilots to issue subpoenas. It allows the Board of Maritime Pilots to enter a ship for investigatory purposes if the ship is open to the public, requires a search warrant for inspections for ships that are not open to the public, and entrance is denied by the owner. There is no amendment, there is no revenue impact, and there is a minimal fiscal impact. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. I assume our first panel is Kim Duncan, David Halton, and Ann McIntyre, and whoever wants to get started, please give us your name and testimony.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Kim Duncan, and I am the chair of the Oregon Board of Maritime Pilots. We're here to talk to you about Senate Bill 601, which our commission has requested, and that Senator Johnson kindly introduced for us. This bill is simple. Our intent on this is very obvious. What we want is to have the Board of Maritime Pilots have a subpoena authority related to maritime incident investigations that we're required by statute to conduct. Our legal counsel is David Hatton. He's with us, and he's also assistant AG.
I apologize. I looked at it and looked like it was Halton, but I see it's two T's, so Mr. Hatton.
And thank you. Also with me this morning is Captain Ann McIntyre. She's a member of the Board of Maritime Pilots and also a Columbia River pilot. Captain McIntyre conducts most of our maritime investigations. To get started, I would like to give you a little background about this board because I think you may not have a lot of issues dealing with it, and it will help give you some context. The Board of Maritime Pilots is the state's oldest board, and it was formed in 1846. It predates statehood. Its objective is to assure the safe passage of ships over the Coos Bay Bar, over into Aquinnah Bay, over the Columbia River Bar, and then up the Columbia River to all the ports between Astoria and Portland. We have three major areas of responsibility. The first includes, is about licensing our pilots. These are the men and women who actually bring the ships up. And all these ships are required to have pilots. It assures their safe passage. The second thing that we deal with are setting rates, pilotage rates, for the ships. And this is very similar to rate making that the PUC does. And we do it with three different pilot groups. And then thirdly, we have a responsibility for safety. And this responsibility entails hiring the best qualified pilots, training them to the best professional standards, assuring that they have good continuing professional development classes. But it also includes a responsibility to investigate maritime incidents. And that's where Senate Bill 601 comes in. We take pride in safety record of our pilotage grounds. Last year, there were two incidents out of about 3,300 transports. So it's a very impressive record. But most of them fall into an area that we call an insignificant incident. You bump a dock, there's not damage particularly, but we investigate everything. But there can be a major incident. And just to give you an idea of what we can look at as major, you all remember the Exxon Valdez. I know you remember the new Carissa. And most recently, there was an incident in San Francisco Bay. This was about a year ago, when a ship called the Costco Busan hit the Bay Bridge. As a result of that incident, we've done a lot of work making sure that what we're doing in our investigative processes are appropriate and can allow us to cope with not only the smaller incidents that we're used to, but potentially a big one. So we realized at that time that we can only issue a subpoena when we're investigating if we have a contested case open. It's not always necessary to open a case. We do need to have the authority to get that investigative subpoena. And we need information quickly and accurately. And that's what Senate Bill 601 is all about. It is supported by our major stakeholders, bar pilots, the river pilots, and the steamship operators. We appreciate their support. We don't expect to use this authority very often, but we do think it's important to have. And finally, we will be asking for an amendment to the bill as it was drafted by Legislative Council. If you'll look on line 27, we would like to delete the word search that precedes warrant and just simply use the phrase warrant. All right, thank you, Mr. Chairman. If there aren't any questions of me, I'd like to have Mr. Hatton speak a little bit to the to some of the legal issues surrounding this, and then Captain McIntyre can answer any questions you might have about investigative procedures.
All right, thank you. Mr. Hatton, in your presentation, I've looked at your comments, understanding that we are working under the APA, and there are some already authority for subpoenas. I am not that familiar with the APA, but it appears that the subpoena power is very limited as to a contested case in instituting it. My question would be, during the contested hearing, does the APA allow for subpoenas to be issued for, I'm going to call it an investigative phase as compared to just commanding or demanding either an individual or documents to be brought to the hearing itself?
Thank you, Senator Pisanski and other members of the committee.
The Administrative Procedures Act does authorize agencies to issue subpoenas once the contested case is open, and both the board and parties to that proceeding would be able to issue subpoenas and other subpoenas to non-parties, discovery to parties to that proceeding. So there is authority under the APA to both initiate discovery proceedings and bring parties to the hearing itself. There are a number of agencies that I've listed in my testimony that do have investigative authority, investigative subpoena authority, where they can issue subpoenas prior to a contested case being open. And this legislation, I think, is designed to assist the board in initiating investigations, particularly in the maritime industry. Both the ships and many of the witnesses are their presence in Oregon is transitory. They're large ships. They're very expensive to operate and run, and they try to bring them unload cargo and get them out again as well. And while the board does have the right to open a contested case and then issue the subpoena, those kinds of hurdles can take a day or two. You would need a quorum for the board to open up the case and then get the discovery. And additionally, in some ways, it's a bit like putting the cart before the horse, because generally speaking, the contested cases would involve licensing and disciplinary proceedings involving a pilot. And many times there isn't the need to discipline a pilot or even open up a proceeding and even prejudge that without being able to investigate. I think may not, it doesn't fit the purpose of the investigation very, very correct, properly. Anyway, we believe that this would be a tool that would better allow the board to carry out that investigation. The board also, under this legislation, is requesting authority to inspect premises, ships, and property involved in a maritime incident and seek a warrant, assuming they have been denied access to the facility by the owner or occupant as well. Currently, the board doesn't have any authority to actually inspect a premises or a ship. And this, again, would be a tool to better allow the board to carry out its investigative function.
Captain, are you here to support the questions? Let me ask the committee this. Do you want the captain to go through the procedure that is used currently now, or do you want to open up for questions? Maybe that will come up through that process. Let's do that. All right, questions? I've got a couple. I want to know. Senator Wissett.
Yes, sir. You made the statement that you wanted to take the search out of warrant to enter. What do you intend to do after you enter?
We intend to accumulate the information necessary to analyze the event.
Search for and analyze the information.
And we are there on an investigative purposes, and that's the distinction.
And a follow-up. If I understand this correctly, you're asking for a subpoena or a search warrant to investigate prior to any complaint being filed. Is that correct?
That's correct, yes.
Then, I don't know the answer to this question, but for instance, the Transportation Safety Board that looks into aircraft incidents and so forth, what kind of authority do they have? Do they require, after a crash or after a near miss or whatever, what kind of authority do they have to investigate an incident And do they have? Does it have to be a file, a complaint filed, or anything preceding their investigation or their right to obtain this information?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Whitsitt, I can probably speak most directly to that, having just returned from a five-day training session at the NTSB.
Captain, I need you to just put your name on the record, please.
Captain Ann McIntyre, Oregon Board of Maritime Pilots. The National Transportation Safety Board works directly at the order of the executive branch of the federal government. So they can respond to any incident that they would like to, and in addition, there are certain incidents that they're required to respond to in all the different modes of transportation. It wouldn't necessarily be related to the investigative function that we have at the state level. There would be instances where we would be a party to their investigation. But the collection of the evidence that we would be seeking, our purposes would be different than that of the NTSB.
I guess, Mr. Chair, my concern is more for the precedent this might set for other agencies to ask the same type of leave, such as Department of State Lands, ODQ, you know, go on and on and on about the various different agencies that might look for the same thing to investigate the possibility of a complaint.
And let me just put on the record, maybe I can cut through this. My understanding is that the federal jurisdiction deals with federal issues. There are some times where the National Transportation Agency is not going to, let's say, engage in an investigation where the state might be looking at that because of licensing, some type of conduct that may be was inappropriate or needing to do the investigation to see what disciplinary actions might be appropriate?
Mr. Chairman, yes, that's correct. On the federal level, there's two agencies that would be investigating maritime incidents, the NTSB and the Coast Guard. The NTSB involvement in an incident would have to be a very major incident, such as the ones that Kim has described earlier. The Coast Guard generally is involved in most maritime incidents that occur. Our purpose in investigating is to discipline the maritime pilot that the board regulates, where the Coast Guard's interest in investigating would be different.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Under Section 3, Paragraph 2B, this is when you're entering the premises to, under A, examine records, documents, etc. B, examine under oath an officer, agent, or employee of the premises, ship, or facility. So could you kind of explain the logistics of that? When you enter to do your investigation, how do you put the person under oath right there? How does that happen?
Again, I think Captain McIntyre can speak to this quite directly.
I guess maybe the best way to explain this would be to anecdotally account an experience that I had in 2007 regarding a container ship registered in a foreign country that experienced a soft grounding with no damage in the navigation channel. Typically what I do when I'm informed of an incident such as that is I immediately make arrangements to board the vessel, interview the captain and the crew that were involved in the incident. In the way our procedure works right now, I don't put them under oath. I just conduct the interview. Generally, I try to conduct my interviews in conjunction with the Coast Guard. And we do have a memorandum of understanding with the Coast Guard for sharing of information. In this particular case, the owners of the vessel denied me access to the ship's logs. They did allow me to participate in the interview, but they did not allow me to collect any evidence on board the vessel because they felt that I didn't have the authority to collect that. They did provide that information to the Coast Guard. The Coast Guard did share that information with me, but there could be potential incidents where the state's interests were not particularly aligned with a federal incident. So, for instance, in a case of pollution, maybe where there was environmental damage to the state's interest in pursuing something maybe different than the federal.
Thank you. Just a brief follow-up. I'm not sure I understand. You said that you didn't put the person under oath. Does this contemplate that you would?
Yes.
Thank you.
No, it's my understanding it could be either way. I mean, the thing, if you have someone that is in the investigative stage, you could just do it as an interview, but you would then have the authority under this bill if you felt that it's appropriate and necessary to put them under oath so there'd be a sworn statement. So if they were lying and it turned out, then you could take other actions based on that conduct itself. All right. Senator Whitson.
One other question that I'd like to ask is this. This would give the board authority to issue a subpoena as opposed to going to the court and asking the court for a subpoena.
If assuming a contested case is not open, the board would have no ability to seek a subpoena, either in court or issue one on its own. It would only be upon the initiation of a contested case proceeding, the board could issue a subpoena under the current law. I think you raised issues about enforcement and whatever. Assuming there were enforcement issues with respect to either a subpoena under this legislation's authority or under a contested case proceeding, enforcement of subpoenas is in court. Additionally, if the board under this legislation sought a warrant, it would have to apply to a circuit court for that warrant as well.
Follow up, please. Yeah. So then if the board issues the subpoena without going to court prior to a case being opened, Section 2 says if a person fails to comply with a subpoena issued under this section, a judge of the circuit court or the application of the board shall compel obedience. So you're basically circumventing the court. You're issuing your own subpoena, and then this law would say that the court shall compel compliance with that subpoena.
That language actually parallels language that parties in cases routinely issue subpoenas, and if they do, if enforcement is required, they apply to the court very much like the board would be under this legislation.
All right. Thank you all very much. We're going to conclude the public hearing, at least for me. Let me just ask if there's anyone else that wanted to give testimony today on Senate Bill 601. Rob Cohen, I apologize. I didn't know. Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't look at the whole list. So Rob, Dave Fiscombe, and Tom Gallagher.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Rob Douglas, representing the Columbia River Steamship Operators Association. We are the agents for the vessels that come in and out of Oregon ports, bringing in autos, taking out bulk cargo. We are in support of Senate Bill 601. We believe this is an essential tool for the Board of Maritime Pilots to conduct investigations of vessel incidents.
Thank you.
Tom? Chair Tom Gallagher, representing the Oregon Bar Pilots. We also support the bill.
Thank you, Dave.
Mr. Chair, committee members, for the record, if that matters, on behalf of my client, the Columbia River Pilots, we're pleased to support this bill. By the way, it's a pleasure to represent Captain McIntyre, as you can imagine. We agree with the legislation as drafted. You'll note the letter from Captain Paul Amos, the president of our association. We have a suggestion at the bottom paragraph of that letter about a word change, but we're not tied to that. We support the bill as drafted. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Thank you all very much. The chair's intent on this is that we will bring this back for work. I understand that we'll look at that request on the amendments before we bring it back. And it's the chair's intent, to, as I said, not only to bring it back, to move it forward. I understand the how this works, and this is really for the investigative part, where you do, in fact, have an immediacy of time of needing to be able to let's say access the ship or the records or a combination thereof. where you do have a transitory population that's going to be moving in and out, as well as the ship itself, unless there's some type of hold that's put on it. And my understanding, just for the record, is that the way this would work is if, in the case of Captain McIntyre, if she was not able to get compliance, she would make contact with probably Ms. Duncan, who would set up a meeting by telephone of the Board of Maritime Pilots, who would then be able to telephonically to give that authority so she could take action immediately. So with that, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 601. And colleagues, we have about 3 minutes. I'm going to go ahead and move the two work sessions that we have right now. Let's go ahead and do those. So we'll open up a work session on 561. And Courtney, if you can show Senator Boquist as being excused. And I also will put on the record that he had to step out for other obligations, but he was in support of both the bills that we're moving forward with at this time. So, Council, real quick on 561.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 561 is the conflict of laws bill that we heard from the Oregon Law Commission. We couldn't move it last time on March 9th because we didn't have the fiscal impact statement. We have it today. There's no revenue impact, no fiscal impact, and no amendment. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yes, you take the motion. Yeah.
I move Senate Bill 561 to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Bonamici moves Senate Bill 561 to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So order from Senator Bonamici, if you'll be our carrier on that one, please.
Thank you, I will.
And we'll close the work session on 561, and we'll open up a work session on Senate Bill 94.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. This is Mr. Taylor's bill, and I'm not ready on this one.
All right, so we're going to wait 30 seconds if he's here, so be it.
I'm sure he's running down the hall right now.
We'll carry it over now. We'll catch him in a deep breath there.
What's that?
We don't
have revenue on 94.
All right.
I wasn't aware of that.
So we're going to not open up this hour. I'll close. Well, I don't think I actually opened up the work session on Senate Bill 94, but what I am going to do is reopen the work session on Senate Bill 561 for the purpose of allowing Senator Boquist to cast his vote on that bill. And so unless there's an objection to... to reopen the work session, Senator Boquist, how would you like to vote? Senator Boquist votes aye on Senate Bill 561. Shall the record reflect that it's a unanimous vote. We'll now close the work session on 561. And at this point, I'm going to carry over Senate Bill 94. That way we can have it if the paperwork gets here for the amendment. So we'll carry that over until... tomorrow we'll do that, since it's Thursday is our last day for these type of bills. So that will be carried over. And then the last thing I want to just give everyone notice is that we are scheduled for meeting on Friday at 7:30. I am going to try to get amendments for the five or six bills that are under the Measure 49 to all the members as soon as they are released to me from LC, so everyone have an opportunity to review those. And with that, we'll close for the day. Thank you.